Well, if it's any smaller than a pint glass, it ain't worth it.
Bob's got pint envy. Okay, folks, welcome to another edition of the No Mind Podcast. My name is Mitch Maxine. Sorry about having to skip a week. We had a tornado come through our town, and the power was out for like 5 days. So we're back up and running. We're offset by a week, but we got things going again. If you've got any questions, comments, as always, leave them on the No Mind Podcast Facebook page, my personal Facebook page, or send an email to nomindpodcast2021@gmail.com. I'm so happy to be doing this, guys. Welcome back. Bob, how's it going, man?
Yeah. It's great. No, it's good to be back. I didn't have the tornado problem, so I've been patiently waiting for the episode to air, to be recorded, and here we are. Great.
I find the topics really interesting. I think Bob chose them. We were given the opportunity to pick our own topics. Bob chose this week's topics, and I was hesitant about what he might come up with, but they're pretty in depth. I think there's room for serious conversation and also a good few laughs in the
offing.
Exactly.
Oh, thanks, Darren.
All right, Lenny, how you doing, buddy?
Good. That's kind of similar to what Darren said.
Hey, he's judging the by the tinkling
the jingle of
ice.
Exactly. That's not my glass. No, when we started this weeks ago, and you thought, okay, how many nights can we go on and speak about martial arts? And then every week we just get topics to go, Christ, how are we gonna condense this down to an hour and a bit? So yeah, really looking forward to it.
You know, that's a good point. Every time we have one of these podcasts, there's at least one moment where we go, well, that's a whole podcast topic unto itself.
Yeah.
Which we never follow up with because my notes are illegible because of the drinking. So anyway, too bad.
On a side note, I was talking to my uncle earlier. I was telling him I had to cut it short because we were doing a podcast tonight. And he said, what's it on? I said, martial arts. He started asking questions about the podcast. And I was explaining it to him. And he goes, how many podcasts can you have about the martial arts? And I said, you have no idea.
There's a friend of mine as well, the same. You know him, Darren Brucey. He was kind of, when you told me about this podcast at first, I thought, martial arts, what can you talk about? And now he's listened to every single one from the start. And he can't wait for the next one, he said.
The poor bastard. just as a preamble to what we're talking about tonight, Darren kind of touched on it, but last time around we were talking and I said, hey, why don't you guys take a shot at coming up with the talking points? And Bob volunteered to go first. So all the talking points that we're going to have tonight, they're not necessarily related. I mean, they're martial arts related, but they're pretty separate. But Bob came up with them. So Bob's going to take this sarcastically, but I actually mean it sincerely. Bob, thank you for taking the time to do that. I know how hard it is to come up with talking points for an entire podcast. So, do you want to say anything in anticipation of the podcast? Go.
Oh, me? Not at all. No, let's just dive in.
Okay, here we go. First talking point. And I'm just going to read these as they're written. If you were to design a kata with complete freedom, and then in brackets he says, credit where it's due, Mark Bell for the idea, because Mark Bell, who was our instructor coming up through the ranks, at least I know for Bob's and my black belt tests, we were required to come up with a kata that we kind of developed from the ground up. Darren, did you ever have to do that?
I don't recall that. I remember you guys did, and I remember watching it. I just don't think I had to for whatever reason.
So Bob's question, if you were to design a kata with complete freedom, what elements would it contain for white belt and for black belt? So I guess we're delineating between white and black in terms of the context of this conversation. So who wants to go first?
I would just assume it's Bob's show. So
I certainly can. I don't care.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Jeez. When you think about a question like that, it brings you to like the basics, the very basic assumptions of what kata is and what it's for and how to teach it and who's ready to learn what. So you take a look at the classical kata and how they're constructed, how they're performed, why they're performed in the way they are, what stances are involved and why, and you start to question all those assumptions that went into their invention, and hopefully the question prods us to rethink those assumptions and come up with new ones of our own first of all, presumably it's a formalized, it's supposed to look formal. That seems to be one of the hallmarks of what kata used to be about, at least in the classical days when they were first invented. You bowed to the front of the dojo, you bowed to the, you know, whoever, and you bowed to the judges, and you did this and that, and you had a set routine, and you started in a specific stance, and you went into that stance in a specific way. And those are some of the assumptions that I like to bring into question. The way we learned it, every one of our kata, you moved into a horse stance in a specific way. And I don't know about starting a kata from a horse stance. I am a fan of, when I think about kata, to try and make it somewhat practical, somewhat more practical than the way you see it done. So, for example, I like the Shotokan way of, you know, bowing in a formal way and then moving into a natural stance rather than a low horse stance. It just seems more natural, so to speak. I kind of prefer that. One aspect that I would probably put into it would be to bow formally, move into a natural stance, and then from there to kind of a natural, relaxed, but potentially fighting posture, where maybe you move your right foot back, so it's a natural stance, but with one leg forward, and arms lowered, arms and fists lowered, just at the ready, rather than stand frontally toward a potential opponent, to move one leg back, to give less of a target, and to get ready to perform the techniques. I wouldn't mind hearing people's input about that.
Jesus.
Let's move around.
You gave way more thought to this than I did, to start with. But going through what you said, you came up with about three or four really, really interesting points, like on a very basic level. And these are just things that jumped into my head as you were talking. Doesn't this require, at least on some level, a discussion of the value of kata?
Right. And presumably we went through that conversation in our own heads while we were thinking about this.
We've gone off topic already. We haven't even started it because... If you remember the question, it's what elements would it contain for white belt and for black belt? The only things Bob had mentioned in terms of elements contained in the kata would be starting position, one stance versus a different stance. So we haven't even really scratched the surface of the question, but can we talk for a second about value of kata? Is there value to it? And if so, what's the value to it?
My angle on this probably comes a little bit different from you guys because our katas are entirely different. What you guys have been brought up on. I'm really only scratching the surface in recent years of the more traditional stuff. First of all, just to segue to the question first, on a white belt, it would be proper execution of effective blocks and punches, however simple or difficult you want to make them, with strong stances and understanding why we do the stances and move between them in a certain way. It's as simple as that. Now, how long or short you want to make it, that's entirely up to whatever you're trying to achieve. From a black belt stance standard, I think, for me, a kata, we have 7 of them to perform in the night of a Shodan grading. And they vary from ones that I would think are actually quite practical to ones that are more demonstrative and ceremonial, for want of a better word. So I'd like to I think, as a black belt standard, I'd like to see them being a more practical application of martial arts. That's something you can say, yeah, okay, that's pretty effective. And a lot of that would involve taking out deep stances, similar to what Bob is saying, in kind of a neutral fighting stance, as opposed to long deep stances and so on. And it would be more intricate and longer because you're trying to encapsulate all your years of training. In essence, a basic short form for the white belt, and a much longer intricate one for a black one. The second part of the question, practicalities of kata, and is it really good? Again, ours are slightly different because of the 7 we learn for your Shodan grade, 2 of them are quite practical. We have a thing called Form 2, and every single perfect kata is a very, very practical application against some kind of lock, hold, or grab. Whereas we have another one called Blocking Form, which is a series of blocks done in deep stances, which, yeah, okay, they're probably, you know, practical in terms of you have to be able to block properly, but the way it's executed isn't really. It's deep stances, very long, overemphasized blocks and so on. So for me, I think the practicality of kata, I'm more leaning towards it's not very practical, but there are some styles and some katas that maybe have some attributes towards it. But That's all. That's my thinking anyway. Tumbleweed descends on the room.
Somebody's preparing something in the kitchen.
That's Mitch. Mitch is gone. The question master's gone.
Sorry, that's me. Sorry, guys. Rick, are you there?
Yep.
Oh. Wow.
Was he in the fridge?
I am.
Was he in the fridge?
Yes,
God damn it,
I locked
myself in the fridge again.
Again.
Son of a bitch. Okay. Okay, folks, joining us on the podcast is Rick Mullen. Rick was with us for the Jewish and Nostalgia podcast, and he was having some technical difficulties when we started this one. And
how you doing, Rick?
But he's here.
Yeah,
so how you doing,
going?
Rick? All right.
Hey, glad
awesome.
To be invited. Glad to be along, man. How's
awesome.
Everybody? Lenny, Darren, Bob.
Rick, nice to meet you at long last. I'll be it across the miles and only by voice. It's nice to meet you.
Well, we did meet once in Ireland.
Yeah. We did.
Wait.
Rick, actually, you were on the trip that Mitch was on and Jason.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Rick
yep.
was there.
Yes. Rick was there. I apologize. Now it all makes sense.
All right, now that the bullshit's over with, let's get back to the podcast.
Was that my first answer? Was the bullshit part? Was it?
Okay, so Darren, what do you think about it in terms of practicality or usefulness of cut? Does cut even have value anymore?
Okay, we've you could have a whole podcast on cut.
We keep saying that.
I know, and like when we started off, Bob had the thing, as you said, between the white belt and the black belt. We've kind of differentiated or strayed from that with Lenny's sort of talk about kata. You want to talk the practicality and all that sort of stuff. Kata has so many different, how do you say, not variations, but values, for want of a better term. You can do it for so many different reasons.
Name
is
three.
Practicality, even though it sounds ridiculous, there are some practical applications for it. Whether it's timing, just working the muscles and the stances, working on your speed, working on your power, all the things that you can't do with an opponent if you have no opponent, those are all practical applications. Whether they seem ridiculous if you walked into a fight, okay, no. But if a boxer's hitting a punching bag all the time, does that have practical value in a fight? Well, yes, it does, even though there's not an opponent there. So kata has the same sort of thing. It's like doing... what do you call it? Shadow boxing without an opponent. That's kata's implications. So the extra things with the low stances and all that, okay, you're working different applications as far as working your muscles, trying to work your speed in a low stance so that when you're in a practical, natural stance, you've already developed the muscles. Do you know what I mean?
Let me throw a question out there that I think kind of typifies my issue with kata. Is there anything that kata provides to your training that you can't find somewhere else?
In certain circumstances, yes, definitely.
Like what? What does kata do for you that something else couldn't do for you as well?
Well, then you could say, what does the something else do that kata couldn't do for you? So it works both ways. So if you say, okay, I'm going to work on my the twitch muscles by getting really low and launching into something really fast, whether it's a jab or a cross or a front kick, and you need to do that over and over really fast so that in a sparring situation you can do it. Well, that's what kata's for. You're in a nice low stance and you've got to lunge forward as fast as humanly possible over and over and over to get that. So kata has those types in it.
Yeah, but let's understand something. None of us are getting any younger. In terms of our training, in terms of my training, I don't want to speak for anybody else. My training time is valuable. I don't have time to do 57 different things. I need to focus on a very few things because my training time is limited and I want to maximize my time.
Ben, so that element would go into the cut, whatever cut that you invented.
That's
what I was about to say.
Cheers to Bob for bringing this conversation back to the actual question.
I was going to associate the same thing with music. There's so many things you could practice and so many genres in music. You have to decide what it is you're trying to achieve and then you develop your practice routine to fit that. So if you're whatever it is you decide, your kata will be designed to fit what you want to accomplish.
Can I just jump in for a second? Because I tried to lay down exactly what I would do for a white belt kata that I invented and a black belt kata that I invented. And I'm going to say them, and then that'll be fodder for more conversation, presumably. White belt kata, start a natural stance, move your right foot back into a natural fighting stance. In comes a high punch. Retreat into a front stance with a high block and an immediate reverse punch counter, something like that. Then back to the natural fighting stance. None of this sequential 20 movements during a kata, that's ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. And to bring things back to reality, I would like to move back to a natural fighting stance before the next technique. So you step back, block, counter. Then you move back to your natural stance. You step back, block, counter with the other side, and then you move back. And you do so for, 20 or 30 techniques. It really doesn't matter. That's a white belt kata. And just out of the blue for a black belt kata, I would do the same thing, except as you move into your front stance or whatever stance it is, there's a simultaneous block and counter for whatever technique's going on. And that just provides a lot of fodder for thought of which techniques. I'm not going to name them or anything. It doesn't matter. But those are the principles of my two kata. Okay, go.
Is kata the only reason you're in? Sounds like everybody's talking about the fighting. And everything's back to related to fighting. Is fighting the only reason that we got into karate? I mean, karate, for me, wasn't just fighting. Being able to fight was a nice offshoot, but it was more my own mental sort of stuff, and I got into it, and I enjoyed the movements, I enjoyed the kata, I enjoyed doing it. So why is kata now suddenly not good? Because at my age, and I am the oldest, so it's starting to show on me that I can't fight for more than about 30 seconds. If I'm not...
I never
I'm either
could.
Dead... True. I'm either finished the fight or I'm finished after about 30 or 40 seconds. So kata gives me something I can do a lot longer.
Darren has brought up the same point in the past. His point then and your point now is like, whatever you feel like doing, just do that. And that's a great point. I have the prejudice of trying to make things as practical as possible. Well, that's just my prejudice. More power to you guys for thinking and saying that.
So, Rick, if you were going to develop a kata for white belts, what components would you include in it? Or do you think the white belt kata that we have are fine as they are? Are they lacking anything? What do you think we could do to improve them?
Well, the thing is with white belts, if you can get them to walk and chew bubblegum at the same time, right? That's more or less what you're trying to get them to do, because they're trying to do a stance, a punch, a block, or whatever, or even just what Bob was saying, step up and step back into a stance and step back up again. It's not something that you're doing all the time, so you want to keep it fairly basic.
You know what? That's a brilliant point.
Yeah.
When we're at a white belt level, we're just trying to get these people to move in a way they're not used to moving, to understand movement in a different way. Does it really matter what moves they do? As long as they're doing particular moves in a particular pattern, it's teaching them how to move in a framework that they've never been exposed to before. Does it really matter what the specific moves are in the kata
at
the white belt level?
Well, if it doesn't matter what the specific moves are, you might as well make the moves as relevant as possible to what we're doing.
Can I interject and ask a question that's completely related? Just because of the nature of the topic that Bob came up with and the way it's kind of evolved from that, Lenny's different because they have different katas, but I've seen the katas that Lenny's do, and it's similar enough that he can engage in the conversation. If you were running your own club and you were designing a kata curriculum from white belt all the way up to black belt, but we'll start off with white belt. What we did was Taikyo Gashoden, Zen Shinkotai, and say 27 movements. Would you change, if you could invent your own or take somebody else's, would you change the curriculum that you were brought up with to something that you feel is more applicable or better suited to whatever style you're teaching? Like for me, Taikyo Gashoden is a waste of time. So since 27 movements is one of the first katas you learn, and there's 27 goddamn movements, why aren't we doing footwork during those movements? And then you've got all your basic blocks and everything you need, and you've got movements at the same time.
See, this is a really good point.
Combining.
I love Taikyo Gashoden, and I'll tell you why. I hate doing it on auto-repeat. Like, every class you go, 27, or Taikyo Gashoden. I've done it 50,000 times.
Well, let's do it backwards.
The thing I love about Taikyo Gashoden is it's so malleable. You can substitute in different techniques for the techniques that are in the kata.
It's got a very simplistic
pattern. And again, for beginners, that's important. You want a simplistic pattern that they can understand and do easily. Once they get that down, you can substitute. And we've all done this.
Yep,
side kicks when you turn, front kicks when you step.
Yep.
Instead of low blocks, do high blocks. On every step, low block, reverse punch instead of block and punch as you step. It gives you such a basic framework that's so malleable and so expandable. I really love that kata. 27
movements.
You know
why, I like these conversations? Because I was ready to write off 27 movements. And you just got me excited about it again.
You take 27 movements and you do the footwork for Taikyoko Shoden.
Shoden with the hand movements of 27 movements. Exactly.
27 movements.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then there's seven left over at the end that you don't have.
Oh, picky, picky.
One time we were in a class, and it was one of those rare classes where, like, there was only five of us that showed up. And Mitch was taking the class, and we were doing some kata. As soon as anyone made a mistake, we had to go back and start the kata over. I can't remember the final outcome, but I remember at least half the class, we were still doing the same kata because somebody was messing it up at some point. And probably myself included. I can't remember.
Not all the same person.
No, there's different people messing it up and different mistakes, and we get to a certain point, and someone would mess it up, and it was just like, Jesus, I wanted to kill Mitch so bad that night. I hated that kata by the end of that night. And I hated everybody in that class.
Including the sadist at the front.
So we're still drifting. We've been at this for 40 minutes. We haven't answered the question yet. So Lenny did kind of. Darren.
I did.
Yeah, Bob did. Darren, if you were going to design a kata from the ground up for a white belt, what elements would you include in your kata?
To be honest with you, you just kind of changed my way of thinking just by that last little conversation. I think I would start off with a kata that was really basic, that covered the most basic of moves, but you could slowly apply different variations of that kata, keeping to the same pattern, that would enable each person to kind of progress through that white belt level.
So you could use that to for all of the kata syllabus for the whole style, all the way up to black belt.
Technically, yeah, except that I don't want to use the same fucking pattern. Sorry. I don't want to use the same pattern. Obviously, things have to get more advanced and whatnot. For the white belt syllabus, I think that's a good way to start, is just to come up with something really basic, and you can evolve from there. And if you're talking about a black belt level, I've seen, again, to take into Lenny's club, I've seen some of the katas. They look ridiculous, but you can see the practicality in the movies.
That was just the students.
but if you're doing some of these katas, it's like sometimes watching a kung fu kata. Remember going to tournaments where they were totally open? You'd see a kung fu guy going in, and you're
That's
like,
so
what
cool.
the hell is that?
Oh, no, I loved watching kung fu kata. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry, Darren.
Yeah, at different points of my time, I've liked it and I've hated it. But I remember seeing some stuff that I just didn't like. It's like, when are you ever going to do that? But at the same time, there's elements in there that I couldn't certainly do. So you're like, okay, what is it being performed for? Is it the practicality of it? Is it to build strength? Is it creativity? What is it? So kata has so many different contexts and benefits and things like that. So if I was designing my own black belt kata to make people do, at this point in time, I wouldn't be able to design one because I wouldn't be able to perform the techniques that I would like to see somebody else that's approaching that level. Just in all honesty. So if I invent a kata, I can't make something up that I can't do because I just wouldn't feel right about it.
Okay, I'm going to take a shot at this. For white belt, I don't think, honestly, given the white belt syllabus that we have at our club, Taikyoko Shoden, 27 movements, I think Zenshin Kotai could be tossed out the window without missing a beat. So I'm just going to keep to those two.
Agreed.
For black belt kata, I would love to add in all the techniques that don't get done in kata through the Q belt levels. There's I just laugh at people who say, well, the reason we do kata is it's a catalog of all the techniques. No, it's not. Because as soon as you exclude one technique, it's no longer a catalog of techniques. I would love to see some kata with some flying kicks in it. I'd love to see some kata with some wheel kicks and some hook kicks And all of the techniques that we have in our curriculum but are not represented in katas in any way. So if I were creating a black belt kata, I would want to include those rogue techniques that don't appear in kata anywhere else in the curriculum.
What about the odd roll in a black belt kata or a breakfall or something like that?
You know what? That's a really good point. I've watched kata at tournaments where they do rolls and breakfalls. Yep. And my knee-jerk reaction is, oh, that's ridiculous. And like Darren said, this is making me rethink that. We do breakfalls. We do rolls. Why not include those in the kata, right? Yeah. Okay, anybody else? No? Yes? Okay, let's go on to the next question then. You're at a tournament. You are a black belt entering a tournament, and you are told that the only kata you're allowed to do is Taikyoko Shodan. Lenny, do you do Taikyoko Shodan at your club?
No, we don't, but we have a similar.
Do you have the hands?
Yeah, there's a blocking form that's fairly similar.
That's what I'm saying. It's pretty similar. It's as basic. It's probably even more basic than.
So for Lenny's sake, let's talk about one of the most basic white belt forms that you have in your style.
No, actually, one of the reasons I asked the question is because of the frequency of front stances and moving from one to another and all those turns and stuff. So I'm hoping that Lenny has a basic kata that includes that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Blocking form is called.
All right.
Okay, so you enter a tournament as a black belt and you're informed that the only kata you can do is, for us, Taikyoko Shonen, and Lenny, for you, that kata. Would you enter that tournament and compete? Why or why not?
I would. I think
I would.
Because it would show how much you have learned. If you're a black belt and you're doing a white belt kata, you're expected to do it really well. So you've got, even just in a straight, just step forward with a front punch. You've got the timing of your feet. You've got the timing of twisting your hips. You've got the timing of where you punch. You've got making sure that everything is straight when you punch. The punch lands just slightly after the foot. There's the contact. There's your inner strength coming out, right? So you're not going to get a white belt getting all of those things being able to do that kata. So it should look like a black belt level.
That's exactly the point. And My reason for asking that question is it would separate the men from the boys as far as black belts are concerned, and it would bring out the fear in everybody.
On that note, if you're going to just a small tournament where the competition isn't very good and there's three or four black belts competing with that basic thing, you would separate the men from the boys easily. Can you imagine that one of the the proper tournaments where the black belts are really, really competitive, they're number one and number two, all that kind of stuff, and you watch a white belt kata performed by three extremely competent black belts, I'm not sure if I would be able to differentiate such precision, like any little tiny mistake, assuming that they're doing it correctly.
You know,
you
it's
just
funny.
Beat me to the punch there, Darren. Actually, I was going to say.
Oh, go ahead, Len. Yeah, go ahead, Len.
I was going to say, for a black belt to come in and perform that, it's got to be absolutely flawless. And I think you would spot any kind of a slip in standard on that alone than you would maybe in a more intricate kata, because it's so simply detailed. Unless you're on point, you're going to be exposed.
It's funny
exactly.
You say
and,
that, Len.
And that's the point. And not only that, but in an ideal world, people would enter this competition. People would acknowledge that they're not perfect. If they make a mistake, they'll acknowledge that they made a mistake. They'll learn something about themselves in entering that kind of a competition.
It's funny because listening to what Lenny just said, I think back on what I look for when I'm judging kata at a tournament. I judge white belts and black belts on exactly the same things. So a more intricate kata at black belt doesn't impress me any more than it would if they were doing a basic kata, because you look for things like balance, you look for things like coordination of movement from one body part to the other, like is my punch landing in time to my hip, in time to my step, is my balance what it should be, am I doing any unnecessary foot movements, whether I'm doing Taikyoko Shodan, or sorry, whether I'm judging somebody who's doing Taikyoko Shodan, or judging somebody who's doing a complex black belt form, I judge them on the same criteria. So for me, when I'm judging, I don't know that it really matters what kata they do. The standard of judgment is the same. For myself, I would love to enter a black belt competition where the only kata allowed was Taiko Shonan. I think that would, like everybody has said, it would expose the high level guys from the people who are the posers, the ones who can't do a really basic kata in the way it should be done.
And when somebody performs an intricate high-level black belt kata, you forgive a lot because you don't know whether it's right or not. In something like Taikyoku Shodan or the basic kata that Lenny was talking about, it's easy to spot a mistake, and that's the crux of the reason for trying it.
I really need to say something here because I don't agree with that. I don't forgive a lot because I don't judge on the fancy flourishes and all that stuff that goes on in the high level black belt kata. I judge on the same thing I judge a white belt on. Even in the most complex kata, there are basic elements, and it's those basic elements I look for. Mm. But when I'm judging somebody.
Sorry, those are in kata that you recognize, right?
No, you can recognize that universally. It doesn't matter what kata you do.
I was just going to say that, Mitch. I mean, I've been on a judging panel where we've, and Darren has as well, where we had Tangsudo, Kenpo, Shitaru, Wataru, Shotokan doing their own katas, and a panel of judges who are all maybe not overly familiar with the other katas, but we all judged it on, is the guy standing correctly? Is he punching correctly? Is he blocking correctly?
But you don't know what a correct block or a correct stance or a correct punch is.
Well.
But you can recognize good balance.
Yes, exactly.
That's pretty much the only thing you can recognize.
No, I don't agree. If somebody's stepping forward in a front stance, when you watch their feet when they move from one foot forward to the other foot forward, there should be, and I think this is universal, there should be a minimum of movement, an economy of movement in your feet as you transition through that stance. And
we're taught to move our feet in a semicircular path. That's not efficient.
Son of a bitch.
Well, that depends on what you want to do with your feet.
Involved a different way of stepping or a different stance, like a different way of standing in a front stance. Like these are the things that if we don't know the kata, and it's not one of ours, we're forced to overlook differences.
You have to overlook some differences, but still, if you're not in a good stance or a semi-good stance when you finish the stance and you're punching, I mean, you can't punch halfway through the stance. You can't step down and be unbalanced while you're punching. Or when you're kicking, you can't be kicking and throwing yourself backwards. Doesn't matter what style you are, you still have to get those things in line.
And exactly what you're saying there, Rick, the initial point was, as a black belt, would you perform this kata? So if you're a black belt performing any kata, another black belt will recognize if he's not balanced there. He's making things up here. Does that make sense? Or, you're going to tweak these things at that level.
Let me ask this, just to kind of tie this question up. Is there anybody who would refuse to do Taikyoku Shonan or the most basic kata at a tournament?
Just on that point, Mitch, I seem to recall a tournament we were at where two of the black belts were tied for first.
Many times.
And the novel idea was that they would each perform 27 movements.
I have a picture of that kata, actually. one of Mike Chapman's tournaments.
Yes, it was.
And John and I, John McCallum, who's the current head instructor at Jiushin, he and I both competed in the black belt kata, and we tied for first and second, and Mike Chapman decided that to break the tie, we would do 27 movements. I applauded that. I loved that. Yeah, it was great. Not only because it tested our ability, but because I think it was really important for the Q belts at that tournament to watch black belts doing basic kata. I think that's really important. Exactly.
Yep, it is.
Then again, I don't want to do one right now. Don't ask me to do that.
Okay, any last comments on that topic before we move on to the next?
No, it was a good conversation.
All right, this next one. I like this next one. So we're talking about talent, and I assume what we mean is
Sorry.
The Joker has joined the conversation.
Why so serious?
I got a bit of a chuckle out of this one when I read it.
Okay, so Bob, when you say talent, I assume you mean inherent ability?
Yeah, born with.
So inherent natural talent, does it have the preeminent role in the student's training? Or does hard work account for most of excellence? That's a really interesting question. Yeah, anybody want to go first?
it's obvious that talent has a role, and it's obvious that hard work has a role. Everyone's seen a child who has obvious talent, and everyone has seen a lot of children that don't have obvious talent, but who work hard and to a significant degree overcome, you know, what they lacked when they came in with. And my point is, someone who's talented and works hard is obviously going to be the best. Someone who is not that talented and works as hard as possible, they're going to be way up there. But I'm just wondering what people think about the different percentages, the different proportions that each one takes. And, you know, feel free to give anecdotes about talented students and untalented students.
Lenny's got 750 students.
No names.
Go ahead, Len.
Why did you pick me first?
Because you've got 750 students, for God's sake.
I'll have seven tomorrow when I speak. From all the students that have come and gone through the club and are still going through, as I say, every kid, and look, like most clubs, my biggest thing is the kids' side of it. As I say to them all, they all come through the door like a baby giraffe on roller skates. And your number one priority.
I like that.
Your number one priority is first of all to stand, then get the skates off, and then teach them how to move. It's like the piece of popcorn. Popcorn eventually pops, but when it pops, is down to how much heat it gets and how much whatever time it gets. So they'll all get there eventually, or should do, and then you always get the little kernels that don't pop in the bottom. But normally, the ones that do pop are in the majority. I would find that, conservatively, I'd say about 70% of mine start with hard work and not the greatest talent. 30% are just naturally gifted. And it normally ends up about 50-50 with the hard work that goes into it. But the big elephant in the room is how much they want to improve themselves. To coin a phrase, that's a podcast in itself, as well, we keep saying.
See, Lenny makes a good point there, because my perspective on this, and I'm not going to take a lot of time, is I don't care whether you're born talented, and I don't care whether you're achieving your ends because you work hard. I judge the ends, at least in the beginner stage. I judge the result. Can you do the techniques competently? Whether it's because you're naturally talented or whether it's because you work hard, I don't think it really matters. Not in the beginning. I think as long as you're able to do the things that are expected of you in a competent way, that's what matters. Now, as you progress through the ranks, and this is a hill I will die on, I will put my money on a hard worker over a naturally talented person any day of the week.
If the naturally talented person doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
Yes, right, well, just, that's the thing.
No.
I'll argue that. Because I don't think a naturally talented person... Look, a naturally talented person can work hard. They can work as hard as anybody. But I don't think that person will ever have the depth of understanding of the technique that someone who needs to slug through every inch of their progress will have. Simply because they don't need to do that.
If you put it into a tournament perspective, the most talented person... In the definition that you gave there, he has to enter a tournament with equally talented people. So there's still that pressure on him to beat somebody else. So it's not just you're talented and you can do a flying kick better than the guys that need to work at it. But when you enter a tournament, you're now up with somebody else that's the exact same as you. So the pressure is still there. You still have to have the work ethic if you want to beat somebody else that's equal to you.
I don't agree with that. I don't think the work ethic is required when you're naturally talented. And because the work ethic isn't required, the naturally talented person will not understand the depth and the subtlety of technique. Let me ask you a question. You got two guys, both black belts. One's been naturally talented his whole life. He just gets it. It just comes to him naturally. The other person... It didn't ever make sense to them, and they really, really had to work hard to understand the technique. Which one of those two people do you want teaching you?
Teaching, that's the question. They'll both perform equally well, or maybe the talented will perform better, but he can't teach it.
That's my point.
You're just assuming the guy with talent doesn't understand the art.
Hang on a second.
That's pretty broad.
And it, you're, well, unfortunately, unless we want to start naming names, we have to speak in generalities. My experience has been, and I've seen lots of people who are naturally talented, they can't teach, generally speaking, as well as the people who don't get it, who achieve the same rank and the same level, because those people have to understand. They have to dig deep into the technique and understand the technique in order to do it. They have to figure it out in their own head. And as soon as you've done that, then you can go and teach it to somebody else. And I don't think that comes quite as easily to people to whom it comes naturally. They don't have to figure it out, or so they don't become as familiar with the subtlety of the technique.
But if they're naturally talented, they already understand the subtlety
of
the technique.
Wait, there's a difference between...
No, here, it's going to be different for everybody. You, maybe what you're saying would be in the percentage of what you're saying, but there'd be enough in the lower percentage to kind of make it arguable.
There's got to be a balance between the talent and the hard work. I mean, going strictly on talent probably won't get you all the way. Going strictly on hard work, I mean, I've seen some students work really, really, really hard. They just don't get it, so they end up dropping out because they can't seem to understand. You've got to have some talent, and you've got to put in a lot of hard work. If you do both, you will be at the top. If you're talented and you don't work, eh. Or if you work really hard but you've got absolutely no talent, eh. Like Darren said, you've got to argue for the bottom, too.
But all things being equal, Mitch is right. You can't teach if you're talented and don't work and don't go through the thought processes. It's not impossible. It's just not typical.
That's what I'm saying. It's just by what you said, you've allowed the fact that some people with talent can teach very well without having gone through what somebody else did.
And like you
said, I'm not saying it's the majority or anything like that. I'm saying there's enough out there that you're either a good teacher, you're not. I've seen people that can't perform shit because they don't have that talent, or it's not a matter of not having the talent, it's, say, body stature, whatever it is, but they're still really good instructors.
I was going to say, Darren, I think the teaching thing is a whole minefield discussion in itself, because we've all known people who are amazing martial arts practitioners, but they have zero. Okay, then, as soon as you said thank
sorry.
You, they have zero people skills. When it
comes, thank you again.
Thank you for recognizing that.
When it comes to teaching, they don't connect with a class. So they just
look,
withdrawn.
Look, if we're going to talk about what makes a good teacher, there's a billion different things that feed into that. So that's a...
You opened it up by saying...
I was just going to say the only reason...
talent cannot teach...
I didn't say that. That's not
I know,
what
I
said.
Know. I'm paraphrasing.
Exactly. All right, so let's focus this in a little bit. Let's go around the table once, just to finish this off. Do you... I can't wait for this. Do you perceive yourself... Look, we've all been training for decades. We've all achieved a certain rank. We've all taught to one degree or another. We've all been involved in the running of a club to one degree or another. Do you perceive yourself as someone who is naturally talented? Or do you perceive yourself as someone who's had to work hard for every bit of success you've gotten, Bob?
Absolutely no talent here. And I feel like I have gone through that tortuous thinking process over everything.
Let's slow down. Are you saying you worked hard for everything you have?
I'm not going to say I worked hard. I worked as hard as I felt like at the time.
Yeah, so you're going for the talent.
Oh, no, I'm not talented at all. I'm sincerely saying
he
I'm
has several ex-wives who will artist. Attest to that.
but if someone who's witnessed that firsthand, I would have thought Bob went a lot further because of raw talent, as opposed to, not opposed to hard work, but if I looked at, say, myself, and what I had to work hard to do, and Bob seemed to be able to do quite naturally. So I would say the talent, you're either not giving you enough credit, or you're trying to say that you worked harder than somebody else.
No,
in the final analysis, it's all up to history. That will be my judge.
But see, this is why I asked the question, because I think we're all perceiving ourselves in very different ways. So Bob puts himself in the not talented, work hard category. Darren? How about you?
Funny enough, I consider myself extremely less talented than Bob, but I would have put myself into a talented category in that there's a lot of things that I felt came naturally to me that wouldn't come naturally to others. And you know yourself, you'd be in the club and you'd see someone that can do the splits no problem, and you're like, geez, I wish I was that talented, or at least had that
Fair
ability.
Fair enough, I was flexible, but that's as far as it went.
No, no, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about anybody. But those people sometimes that can do the splits, there's no power in their kicks. Their talent might be able to do one thing, but it's not the same as somebody else's talent. So I think even the most spastic person coming into a club will have something that they're naturally good at that'll be better than somebody else's. So it's kind of you go to your strengths, you go to your talents. So in your question, yeah, I thought I was talented, not in the grand scheme of things where it says you're really talented, but I think I had natural abilities that allowed me to kind of work hard on other things to bring them up, or at least take advantage of what you have and use that. So you might not be as good as somebody else in another area, but you might get by if you really work on what talents you do bring to the table.
Rick, what do you think? Talented or hard worker? Or both? Or what do you think?
Or neither.
Or neither.
I just suck. I'm no good at all.
I'm just bad.
No, it's bad.
Basically, I had to, as far as I'm concerned, I had to work my arse off to get wherever I went and to get up through the ranks. And Bob, if you don't count your ball-bearing hips as a talent, yeah. I might Crick. Agree more with what you were saying, but no. Your hips, enough. I cannot do what you do with your kicks.
I did. Let's get into
that. Okay, right. Did. Well, hey, there's a lot of things I used to hips. Do that I can't do now, too.
Bob's man. Hips have fused in the last few years.
But I think it was more mostly hard work. There was some, I guess, some talent, because I seemed to take to it pretty easily. And I liked it, and I enjoyed it, and I did seem to, you know, find the cutters and get sparring and stuff. But it was still an awful lot of work, man.
You see, my background, this comes from a totally prejudiced condition, because I was fat, I was ginger, and I was called Leonard. So I was always going to be the hard worker to fight society.
True.
Who said true, Darren? You're
that
dead.
Was Rick.
I did.
No,
but in your in the context of your abilities as a martial artist,
I would say 90% hard work, 10% talent, and still to this day, here we are all these years later, and I'm still looking to improve myself all the time, because I think that's lacking in what I do. So,
okay, yeah. Mitch,
I didn't ever get any of this. I always felt like some big lumbering lummox stumbling through a china shop. I never understood this, and it was always my biggest challenge was to make myself understand how to do these things that were completely beyond me. I absolutely put myself in the not talented, hardworking category.
Okay, folks, let's go on to the next talking point. For adults, is it more dignified? And I'm not sure why we're delineating between adults and kids, but whatever. It's Bob's talking point. For adults, is it more dignified not to implement the traditional belt colors, but to only wear a white belt or a black belt? Or why do we even have belts at all? Who wants to take that and run with it?
I'll have a go at that.
I think...
What's he going to say?
What you just said about to differentiate between adults and kids, I think we touched on ever so briefly, whereas I think kids need something to look forward to get them to the next level. Adults, one would assume, wouldn't need that same kind of aspiration thing. But I think with the belt level, it helps on so many levels. It gives somebody something to strive toward. It gives an instructor an idea of who's in the class. If you've got a whole bunch of white belts in the class, but there are varying levels of white belt. You might have a white belt that's been training for 2 years, one that, as Lenny said, just joined a few weeks ago. So how do you differentiate? How do you pair them off? If it's in a tournament setting, how do you deal with it that way? So I think the belt structure, it allows for that sort of planning in the grand scheme of things. I think if you're just in training, you should be able to just train forever. Like weightlifting, there's no belts in weightlifting. You just recognize that you're getting in better shape, maybe better physically or stronger. You don't need a belt system.
But that's a good point. In something like weightlifting, you don't need a belt system. People know who the powerhouses are. People know who's good and who's not. Do we really need a belt system inside of a club structure? I'm not talking about tournaments, because that's a different issue, but let's talk about inside a singular club. Do we really need a belt system in order for people to understand who's good and who's not and who's advanced and who's beginner? Len, you've got the biggest club I've ever heard of. Do you rely on your belt system to help you understand where your students are in their progress? Or do you just know because you work with them all the time?
I kind of know because I work with them all the time. You can probably throw me any name from the club of any age and I'll tell you exactly where they are progress-wise and where they are belt-wise.
Which that's might not be the same.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, valid point.
Well, I'm being sarcastic, but technically...
Yeah, no.
But
yeah,
ideally, it should be, obviously.
It,
but
yeah, it is. It's damn close.
That's a whole different issue. There's all this subjectivity involved, but let's not go off topic. Keep going.
But it's purely because I spend so much time there and I'm working with them so much. That being said, look at it from a student's point of view. When we line up, we put the more senior grades at the front of the class and you put the more junior ones at the back purely because they can learn from what's going on in front of them. If they're most senior at the front, they have things nailed properly, which they should. Every line behind can watch what's going on in front and learn from them. So I think in that respect, a belt structure is invaluable. So I think it has that benefit. As I was saying with Darren there earlier, the white belt, black belt, yes, there's a lot of times I do think that maybe it should be just one or the other, but then you get up in the complications of when you go to compete. You know, you got a white belt who's there 3 weeks and you got a white belt who's there 6 years. That's another big can of worms. And then to really mix it up, then you say, well, hang on a second, who are we to change the traditions of something that's thousands of years old? It's the other way.
Oh, yeah, right. Come on, just because something's thousands of years old doesn't mean it's good.
And the ranking system is what? Around 1900 or something?
Exactly. I suppose so. Yeah, okay, yeah, valid
didn't
point.
Didn't they used
point.
To just have one rank and the sensei knew what you were doing and went on?
There was
a
point where there wasn't any rank. People just, just trained. They just worked out. They just trained. There was no rank. Rank wasn't introduced until they tried to systematize it in order to compete. Rank is a reasonably new construct.
Was it purely for competing?
And started introducing it to the Western world.
Sorry, yeah. Len. That's a good point. It wasn't just to compete, but I think it wasn't. I thought it was. Does anybody have any insights on why they introduced rank?
I have a dim memory that maybe it was around the Funakoshi inventing the Shotokan kata and implementing his teaching in the schools.
Probably because he would have had obviously the varying levels of the kata. So you're assuming that a white belt is not going to say sit down and learn a more advanced kata. So you have to distinguish between a white belt and someone that's of a rank that can learn the advanced kata or technique, whatever it is.
But here's one to really mess it up. You hold a black belt in your own style and you walk into a new style. You're a white belt. You can clearly move and pick up stuff a lot. Yeah, you should. Yeah, and you should clearly move and pick up stuff a lot quicker than someone who's just starting off from absolute beginner.
The thing is, look, I've had experience with clubs where anyone can walk in off the street wearing a black belt and they'll be welcomed into the inner circle just because they're wearing a black belt. I don't agree at all with the deference that's paid to people simply because they're wearing a black belt. If I walk into a Goju club or a club outside of the style that I've trained in, I don't know jack shit about how they do stuff. I don't do things that they do. I don't do things the way they do. I don't do my kata the same way. The dynamic of the kicks may be different. Why should my rank be so transferable? That makes no sense to me.
I made an announcement that I wanted to start training in Aikido. This was, 30 years ago? And my instructor at the time insisted that I should walk in with a black belt and insist that I be recognized as a black belt.
But Aikido's not karate.
No.
Really?
Oh, sorry, okay.
I thought, like Bob, it was not until early 1900s that they actually introduced a ranking system. Because other than that, before that, they didn't need the ranking system, because if you started being taught by a sensei, he probably only had 20 students. He knew who was higher and who was lower.
Okay, let me do this. But here, you got to figure too. Like back then, we're talking about modern times. Everybody thinks differently now. That's obvious. Back then, you were learning the art because you had to defend yourself. Literally.
Right, exactly. People are trying to kill me.
Yeah, I
think that steps up my motivation.
I only got an orange belt, man. You guys leave me alone. Head toward those guys.
Push the yellow belts in front of you. Toward
exactly.
The guys.
line the yellow belts up in front.
I was just going to say, that's a good reason to have the belt system back in those days.
Right. Oh, so you know who the fodder is.
Yeah, you guys head in.
Who's the mother? Who's the fodder?
We'll follow in behind. Rick, let me ask you a specific question. You and I both still train and to some degree teach at Jushin. If the notion of eliminating Q belt rank and just having white belts until you're a black belt was introduced, what would your thoughts be on that?
Given the age of our students that we get and whatnot, they would not come to us. Because people today, kids today, they need that gradation. They need to say, they need to be able to be told, oh, you're doing well and you're getting ahead, so you get a yellow belt. You get a yellow belt straight, then you get an orange belt, then you get, they need that reinforcement. So I don't think they would stay with us.
Len, what do you think? What do you?
Big time.
If I'm assuming then, Len, that you would not think of introducing a white belt, black belt system at your club.
From a purist point of view, you would, but from me, because it's my livelihood, it would be absolute suicide. You know, so in one sense, I'm kind of selling out to the man because it puts a, you know, pays the bills and whatever. It's also, I think, it sparks more enthusiasm in your students that, okay, I got a grade coming up, I got to meet the next one, I got to reach the next one.
Yeah, but you know what the downside of that is, and I've seen students who become so caught up in the trappings of training rather than the actual training. It becomes more important to them to have a particular rank than it does to train so you deserve that rank. I think that's one of the biggest downfalls of the ranking system, is that it replaces the notion of training for the sake of it with training for the reward of training.
But that's the instructor then. That's,
I was just going to say...
My
you had said that a little while ago, that's up to the instructor to drive that point home.
Yeah,
and the other thing is, if you just want to look at a positive note, anything that gets people into train is a good thing. Mm-hmm. So if you're going into train and you want that belt system and that's what keeps you training, that's a good thing. If you're deciding whether to train or not and the only club in town does this weird system that doesn't suit you, so you decide not to go, you're missing out on that. It almost seems like a kind of, it's like anything else. When you have your students, you know the ones that are just paying the bills, you know the ones that are going to drop out at a certain amount of time, and you know the ones that you're going to devote your time and attention to because they're going to make something of themselves. So everybody sort of has their part to play in the grand scheme of things, and you kind of cater your dojo or whatever it is to suit that.
All these points about the incentives behind the ranking system are very well taken, and I didn't think of many of them when I made up the question, but all this talk reminds me about, it's like a military rank, and I understand that analogy. Yep. It's being in a military setting and insisting people call you general. It's just a little cringy for me, that's all.
I think that's all the Western thing. Like back when all this stuff was coming to fruition, or whether it was an everyday thing, you just had somebody that taught you the stuff and you learned it and you fought and it was survival and that was it. And that's fine. Later on, it became a health issue and all the other things that martial arts have come to be over the years. And when it came westernized, like everything else in Western civilization, like it comes with all the other traditions that the Western civilization has. So that's when you get the ranks and you get the prestige and the vanity and all that other sort of stuff and the competition. That none of that came from tradition. So it's just something that sort of evolved over time. I think there's good aspects of it and bad aspects. And again, it's up to the instructor, the club, or the organization to be able to pass on the most appropriate stuff to their students. And don't let the students get caught up in all the bullshit and the vanity and all that stuff. You should be able to project your ethos on the students so that when they come through, they follow the same ethos that you're doing. They don't get caught up in the other bullshit.
The analogy about the general is right on, because this is called martial arts. This is martial arts, which is military, which is war arts. It's the same thing.
I just wanted to spur a little conversation, and I really like what I've been hearing, but I especially like hearing Darren say the word ethos.
Nice. Darren, say it again for me, baby.
The dummy said something.
All right, I'll tell you what. Let's go once around the table. Just last thoughts on the white belt, black belt versus a colored belt thing. Lenny, what do you think?
I've constantly flip-flopped between the two. The more I think of it, I think from a large school point of view, it's invaluable because people can learn from each other. It keeps you a good progress of who's where in the curriculum. And once it's spelled out at the start, which it was from day one with me, when my instructor was, a belt is for holding your bloody trousers up. These coloured ones, it just gives an idea of where you are along your path. I'd still stick with the rank structure.
Rick?
I was just thinking that, you know, we've all been in the martial arts or karate or whatever, which practiced for many, many, many years, and it gets to the point where you say, you know, rank really doesn't mean anything. But looking back, when I started, I was a white and yellow belt. I watched the brown belts spar, and there was some pretty good brown belts in our clubs. So when I got my brown belt, it was like a sign to me personally that I'm starting to, you know what I'm kind of doing. So it does give you that in your own mind, that gradation too. The other point that Lenin was saying too is, and he was saying, if you don't have that, I don't know whether a lot of our Western people would actually still be in it.
Yeah, just to kind of add an addendum onto that is, I think you need the gradation up to a black belt.
Yep.
We all know that the general consensus of when you reach black belt level, that's when your learning truly starts. You can kind of use the same argument to say,
ethos.
Okay, as a black belt, no, I was going to say that, but it's not an ethos. You can use the same kind of generalization to say that, well, when I reach a black belt, if that's truly where I start to learn, then that should be truly where my rank starts. And then I try to strive to get to the next and the next and the next. My own opinion is, if you're a black belt and you're wearing stripes, there's something wrong with your ego. It's as simple as that. Nobody has to know. If you have things to strive for and you want to improve and you have rungs of the ladder you want to climb, that's fine and that's all great. But once you reach that level, if you have to have gradations to strive for and stuff like that, then you've lost something along the way. If I see a black belt with the stripes, I immediately think of ego. I wear the same black belt I got back in whatever, we won't say the date, but I don't need any stripes on it. I don't need any nothing. And if anything, the more stripes you have a black belt, by the time you age enough to get those stripes, you can't perform to the curriculum that those stripes indicate. So it just
shrinkage makes the belt not fit.
That's what I was going to say. I thought you were going to say by the time you get the stripes, you can't fit into your belt anymore.
I don't know. See, I'm losing weight.
Okay, I'm going to throw my two cents in. It was Bob's topic, so he goes last. You guys have covered all the really good points about this. I advocate for training for the sake of training. I have to admit, when I look back on my progression through the ranks, when I got my yellow belt, I couldn't have been prouder of having that yellow belt. I think I was prouder of my yellow belt than I was of my black belt, honestly. I went home with my belt and I put it on and I stood in front of the mirror and looked at myself and
You had a gi on, didn't you?
Yes, I did. No, I was naked. No, honestly, when coming up through the ranks, rank was presented as the milestone of your training. So when you got a different colored rank, in my head, it was representative of the fact that I was moving in the right direction. I never cared about the rank for the sake of the rank. I always wanted the rank because it was presented as the milestone of your motion forward. That's why rank was important to me coming up through the ranks. So.
That's the same nowadays. If you buy a new car or you move apartments or houses or anything like that, it's all milestones. So if the rank happens to be the representation of that, I don't see anything wrong with it.
No, there's nothing wrong with that, but where it becomes tainted is when people start valuing the rank over the meaning of the rank. Or
the actual practice you have to put in to get that rank.
Exactly. When people would rather have the rank than be able to say, I worked to achieve this. I'd rather spend the time training and get no rank than not do any training and be given rank. You know what I mean? Anyway, okay, Bob, your thoughts.
Well, the spirit in which I wrote the question was exactly what Mitch was just talking about. But I've been hearing like a lot of illuminating things all around the table, and I'm just glad I asked the question. It was a good conversation. Good conversation.
I don't hear an opinion about the topic.
That's what I was just about to say.
Loaded up to go there.
Your opinion is...
Okay.
Politician.
I think that's from a vote.
Yeah, I'm running for city council. Vote for me. I think the consensus is correct. Kids, not baby goats, children, need the ranking system, or at least it benefits them greatly. And beyond black belt, forget it. Like, I don't see any supporting argument for that stuff above black. Anyway.
Okay, Bob has one final talking point that he came up with that none of us know. So, Bob, let's hear it.
I actually didn't make this up today. It was lost on my iPhone somewhere in data storage. But all right, here's the question. As a black belt, give us a situation where you were the asshole. You did something you regret.
Oh, can I go first? I have so many, but one jumps to mind exactly.
Go for it.
Back in the day, and Rick and Darren and Bob will remember this, we would go to summer camps, and there was this game that we played where there was this wooded area in this camp where we'd have our camps. The cue belts would start on one side of the wooded area, and the black belts would start on the other, and we'd all move to the other side. We'd try to get to the opposite side. If a cue belt saw a black belt and they were able to tap them, then they would spar, and whoever won got the belt of the other one. And then you'd come out on the other side and see the most belts, and wasn't it fun, and blah, blah, blah. And this was very early in my black belt life, and I still remember the other individual. I was running through the woods, and an orange belt girl, her name was Sheila, she managed to tag me, and I turned to her, and here's the part where I'm an asshole. In a very sarcastic, arrogant, condescending way, I looked at her and went, "You're ready?" Like she, as though she had any chance of beating me. And I'm going to give Mark Bell kudos. He witnessed that, and he tore a strip off of me. He went up one side of me and down the other, and he just about... Wow, he eviscerated me for that, and he was right. It was a completely arrogant asshole thing to do, and to this day I think about that, and I cringe about how arrogant it was of me to treat her that way. Who wants to be the asshole next?
I remember once we were working out. We did that thing where we do punches against the tree bark, right? Punching a tree. Punch, 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 punch. And since they had us doing the things, and I was a black belt at the time. And of course, I'm also sometimes rather too free with comments, comical in nature. I punched the punch, and I went, "Ow!" And Sensei says, "Who said that?" Well, there was a new guy sitting beside me. He did, Sensei. The guy looked at me. He never came back. I mean, never came back to class. I'm thinking afterwards, I guess maybe I shouldn't have blamed him. Because I figured Sensei would know because he knew my voice. So apparently the new guy didn't.
Next. All right, who's next?
I'll go. You know the way we were brought up at Jushin? It was very militaristic, and the instructor was not encouraged, but fairly expected to be less of a positive reinforcer than a negative one. There were a lot of... admonishments given out, and when I decided to open my own club with the help of Mitch, I took that ethos to heart. Thank you, Darren. And I did a lot of negative reinforcing in that club, and I think I look back on it and I think of it from the children's perspective. I was hard on them. I know I was. I'm not sure whether that ultimately was a good thing or not. A lot of them were really enjoyed their time at the club. Some of the young ladies were in tears sometimes, and I look back and I cringe. I think maybe I could have handled the entire thing from a slightly different perspective. I would like to lean back on the excuse that that's the way I was brought up, but it wasn't entirely that. I was a little mean sometimes, and I regret that. Anyway, go ahead.
Bob, was there a circumstance that you can remember that you can directly link a student's reaction to tell you that you were that kind of an asshole, or is it just you pondering perceiving. Who you actually were.
I really can't remember any specific instances, and it's just a look back on this, and what do I think about when I look back on it type of thing.
Fair enough. Darren?
I don't want to ruin this whole thing or anything, but I've been thinking about it the whole time since you brought up the question. I can't honestly think of a time that bothers me. I believe you.
given the way you talk about your motives and those around you, I have no problem believing that, Darren.
No, I just think I'm always vote for the underdog. I always get sentimental for the people that aren't very good and kind of devote more time to try to bring them up to the standards where they can feel good about themselves. So I'm sure there was here. I'm definitely an asshole. But just maybe not in the circumstances that pertain to this particular conversation, or at least that I can think of. If somebody out there listening remembers the time that I did something stupid, I'll own up to it.
Oh, the deluge of emails that are going to come in.
Because, when I was growing up, I had confidence issues. I was always trying to strive to be better and never thought I was good enough. So I could never see myself in a position where I would condemn someone else. Because I just know what it felt like to always be trying to do something. I wouldn't want someone to be an asshole to me, so I think that just sort of permeated into what I am today, whether it's by choice or not. And as I said, I'm sure there's times where I would have been, but it never would have been an instructable point of view, because I just...
Okay.
Hey, Darren, you remember the time we were at your dad's place and I was trying to give you a ride home? Do you remember that?
I was an asshole! yes, totally. But that wasn't, we weren't training. We weren't.
Yeah,
training.
That wasn't martial arts related. That was.
Exactly.
I don't want to know anymore here, guys.
That was hilarious.
I know I've been.
It's fine. I thought that was funny.
To training, but yeah, I forgot.
Okay.
Excuse Lenny. Me, but for the sake of the audience who doesn't know what the hell you're talking about, what? Tell me it wasn't sexual.
I'm good. Long story. I'm editing this whole bit out anyway, so. And Bob, just to put your mind at rest, it was completely sexual.
Oh, okay.
So you were at Sunset Place and you were taking Darren home.
I'm not finishing the story. He didn't want me to drive him home. Okay, thought he was fine. It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Oh, okay, Lenny. Lenny, are you there, Len?
Yeah, I'm here. I've been sitting in silence. Just, hang on, let Darren laugh there.
You got to do that every now and then, Len.
Okay, Len, your turn. Can you remember a time in your martial arts career when you were an asshole? Go.
No.
Whoa.
Fair enough.
That's something.
No, I can. I can. I can. And it was just the whole topic, which I'm going to delve into someday, of parents involving themselves in what they perceive their children's progress should be. And it was one parent who wouldn't let it go about her child had been training for so long and his friends had been training for so long and they'd gone grades ahead of him and he hadn't, and I was trying to impress upon her that he hadn't reached the standard required, and it wasn't just a case of you serve your time and you get your belt. And she got really irate about it, and I basically cut her in two one day to finish the conversation. I said, listen, it's like this. I'm basing my expertise on 30 odd years of martial arts training. What are you basing yours on? Nothing. Didn't think so, and walked away. And I felt so bad afterwards, because it wasn't right. She's a customer, she's a concerned mother. I probably shouldn't have been so blunt. So yeah, that's it.
You know, I just want to say I'm glad of this podcast, of the fact that it exists, because I didn't know this stuff about you guys. It's a great forum for this kind of crap.
Okay, guys, that about brings the talking points to a close. First of all, I want to say thank you to Bob for taking the time to come up with those. We've got infinite number of podcasts ahead of us, so hopefully in the future, each one of us will take the opportunity to come up with some talking points. I just want to go around the table once real quick, 15, 20 seconds. Any final thoughts you want to put out there? Lenny?
Look, I don't know how many weeks we're into on the podcast now, and what started out with you having random guests has turned into the panel, which has only grown, and I think every week it's just getting better and better, and it makes you think really hard. When you sit down, sometimes you even change your whole point of view for years in the space of 5 minutes on this, so keep it going. It's great.
Rick, last thoughts?
I echo Lenny there. This is kind of fun. I've been included in a couple, and I appreciate being included. Lenny, I wish you were over here, too. It'd be great to see you and Have you come?
It'll happen someday, for sure. We'll get there someday.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'm not going to drive you home. I'm not going to ask you to drive you home.
No. Questions today were kind of cool. It makes you think. It brings stuff to mind. I'm still deciding whether I'm actually going to do a cut the next weekend, so there you go.
Darren.
Yeah, I would. I two things. My first thing was, I don't have to compete next weekend because I'm a black belt, so I just don't have to. and I don't have any students that have to see me do it, so I'm okay with that. But I'm with Richie kind of there. I was like, here, I could do something. I couldn't do something. I've had this conversation with Len. It's like, yeah, I could do a kata, but I haven't done a kata like since the last tournament, and I didn't do a kata before that since the last tournament. So there's not even practicing before that. But there is a thing about competing that I just enjoy. I enjoy being on the floor. I enjoy being part of that whole thing. Whether you win or lose is irrelevant. It's just kind of getting the whole spirit of things. So with that one topic that Bob brought up, I didn't realize it was so intricate and had so many facets of it. I just had my own opinion and that was it. So it was interesting to see something that I thought was actually not a topic blossom into a topic with different opinions and stuff like that. So once again, like, it's like every week I think I know what I'm talking about, and I realize how little I know just by talking to everybody else that knows a lot more than me.
Bob, last thoughts?
Well, it was interesting to hear Darren so flippantly say, well, it doesn't matter if you win or lose, who cares? try telling that to 98% of the people that we are around, or were, in my case, was around. It's refreshing. Your perspective, Lenny's perspective, it's good to hear, that's all.
All right, folks, we're going to bring this one to a close. I want to thank everybody who's tuned in to listen. I especially want to thank the guests, Rick and Darren, Lenny and Bob. Thanks,
You're
guys,
welcome.
For coming on.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. This is going to be it probably for a week or two because we've got the tournament coming up. So it'll be a couple of weeks before we record another one. That's it, folks. Thanks so much.
Wait. I'm looking forward to doing the theme song with Rick next time he's on.
Oh,
we've got 3 weeks to learn it.
Exactly. We'll make a point of it.
Somebody all right, guys. Send it to me. I'll try and learn it.
Don't be off.
Listen to a podcast once in a while, for God's sakes. It's on every. It's on every. Anyway, all right, we're done. Thanks, folks. We're gone. Peace out. Have a good night. Bye bye.